The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On April 5th, 2007, the Korea Society hosted an arts program titled How Did Korea Become a Land of Apartments? With Valerie Gillazo, Associate Professor of Geography at Marne-la-Vallée University in France, and author of The Republic of Apartments. Gillazo explained how South Korea has transformed from a country of single-unit housing to one where apartment living is the dominant paradigm. Gillazo believes that in addition to economic and demographic factors, such as a growing population and a shortage of buildable land, the change has been driven by cultural factors.
Thank you very much for this introduction. It's a great pleasure and an honor to address the audience of the Korean Society today, and I want to thank the Society for inviting me to talk, and all of you for coming to that talk. I think it's always a very good thing to have great chance to get some feedback on what you've worked on and what you've wrote. And it's especially for me, it's good to get a feedback in another country outside of my own country, which is France, or outside Korea. And I got the opportunity to do it as I was here in the U.S. for 2 years. And to jump on what Mr. Correa said, actually I think the neighborhood in Sodom when he was mentioning probably disappeared. It's something that is very very specific as a geographer when you work on Seoul. It's like the city is very constantly changing and constantly reconstructing, and it's a plastic city. And so when you don't go, when I don't go to Seoul for 1 or 2 years, some areas, they totally transformed. And it's very specific to that city as well. So this talk is based on this book, Apate Gongwaguk. And I will present certain aspects of it. This is a book that is a multi-layered reality or an adventure for me. It was an adventure because it started as a PhD dissertation in the early 1990s with a very grim title, I will spare you anyway. And the question I always get is, why did you get interested into that really boring and awful topic of apartments? And actually, apartments just imposed themselves to me, as Frederick Correa really well expressed. You can't avoid it. So during that footage, they had apartment in the footage, and as you mentioned, it was the late 80s, if I understand. So it's even, and the late 80s was actually a turning point also with the development of apartment. So the first time I came to Korea in 1990s, I was on language training and I was studying for a master's degree, and I was actually working on public spaces in Asia. And I realized that this landscape, this cityscape was very specific, and that apartments were a major icon of the Korean cityscape. And I could not find other example of that power of this environment, this daily environment that is affecting every people in the city. If you don't live in an apartment, you live next to it, you work in it, or you see apartment in the newspaper. So you cannot just avoid it. It's a major thing in the Korean society. So I came back to France, and then I went to see my PhD advisor, and I said, well, I want to switch topic. I think public spaces is not, it's interesting, but I want to work on apartment now. And then he said, oh, but are you going to work on impoverished neighborhoods? I said, no, just let me work on that topic. I think it's very important. And so this PhD dissertation was So that's the French version. There is no English one. And then it was translated into Korea with a very grim title, Apatayangu, very boring title. But then it actually caught some attention, and so some colleagues of the Asiatic Research Center in Korea University decided to just do a new translation, and in the meanwhile, I did some other field work, especially because that was just at the time when the riots burst out in the French suburbs, which are characterized by also apartment development. And so I could add a new chapter, and this is this gave the book I'm going to present some aspect tonight. Oh, should have started this. So let's go back to the Korean cities and start with this really striking view of Ilsan Shindoshi, or Ilsan New Town. And in fact, as has been said, Korean cityscape today is really, well, dominated by apartment complex, as shows this view of Ilsan. And this, actually, this apartment complex in Ilsan could house, is what I call a megaplex, a mega-sized apartment complex. And it could house about what is the size of a mid-sized city in France. So this is also very peculiar to the South Korean development. If we just want to reflect on that constatation, on some figures, so for example in Seoul, and Seoul has always been, as we'll see, a kind of laboratory for urban development. So the share of apartment houses jumped from 4% of the housing stock in the 1970, so to speak, nothing, to 53% in 2006. So now apartment is the norm. It is the norm as a housing development. And in the same period of time, single-family houses, detached houses, went from 88% of the 1970 housing stock to only 25% in 2000. So, in fact, that is also an important idea. When you consider with the apartment other types of collective housing, such as the row houses, the yeollipjuttaek, or multifamily dwellings, you also, Mr. Carrier also mentioned, the dasadejuttaek. So more than two-thirds of the housing in Seoul is today collective housing. And also, as I mentioned, this was coupled with the development of megaplexes. So in a short time, we have to realize that the Korean housing culture went to a drastic change, changed totally, went from a culture of the detached dwelling to a culture of collective housing or collective habitat. And now this phenomenon is particularly striking when one considers the fact that apartment complexes were almost completely unknown, and collective housing in general was completely unknown to Korean city dwellers in the early 1960s. So today, as I said, you can't avoid apartment, but in the early 1960s, it was just a non-known urban object, an absent urban object from Korean cities. So Korean city, Korean culture was not a culture of collective housing, even in cities, contrary to some other cultures of the world where you had collective housing before the modern era, such as the Mediterranean cultures or the Middle Eastern cultures. So it's a totally drastic change of habitat and daily environment. So this raises some issue. This raises the issue of the relationship with modernization of South Korea, which is also really related to the pace of industrialization. So Korea modernized and became, in a short time, an urbanized country. And today, over 80% of the total population is urban in Korea. Now, on the architectural aspect and the material aspect of it, the modernization of cities is tightly connected to modernism. And as some of you know, in architecture and city planning, modernism was a movement organized by leading figures of architects, such as Gropius or Mies van der Rohe or Le Corbusier, around the International Congress of Modern Architecture in the 1920s and in the 1930s in Europe. And at the end, so the modernity is the character of a modern society, the emanation of it, especially in the social and cultural dimension. And we'll see that how apartments are connected to this three dimension of the change. Another very important issue for me was to confront the totally opposed views of apartments in France, where they have been at the core of post-war reconstruction in France, and in Korea, where apartments have literally created the modern cities. So when I started my research in the beginning of the 1990s, so the South Korean view on apartments was, for the majority of people, it was a dream to live in an apartment. It was very positive among the general public, and it still is. Lots of people dream to live in an apartment. And also another commonplace about Korean apartment was the one assuming that apartment was the only choice for resolving the housing problem in a context of rapid economic growth and a shortage of land. And so this is usually the answer I got when I was beginning my research. In brief, well, why do you wonder why we become a land of apartment? There is a shortage of land, plus too many people. So we don't have the choice. We have to pile up the houses. So this was very depressing to me, because it actually showed how pointless my research was. So the answer I got in Korea was very discouraging, because to some extent it showed how my research was so pointless, and everyone had the answer to my questions. So now I came back to France, and my colleagues had another very deterministic view on apartment, which is just the opposite to that of Korea. They assumed that I was actually working on the equivalent of Korean suburbs or banlieue, which is a very negative connotation, and that I was working on social housing, on impoverished neighborhoods. And I had to explain that Gangnam, for example, was not particularly an impoverished neighborhood in Seoul. So I was confronted to very opposite view of the city here. And so we'll probably address that during my talk as well. So here is the page that probably looked very familiar to all of you, because that kind of images are everywhere in Korea. It is a representation of several projects which were under construction by Samsung Construction in the mid-1990s. So you see all apartment complexes in different sizes and shapes. So there are types of apartment all over Korea, and that all of them were constructed. So that, again, to emphasize the power of that type of environment. So I will first try to show and to address the question of the various origins of the apartment model. Where does this model come from? And I will try to show it's actually the result of a hybrid modernism. And then I will show how, in the context of severe urban growth and housing problem, the apartment drove a mass housing policy that actually was a tool to control, to allow large-scale population control in Seoul, which was very important as well. And then I will try to show how the apartment literally manufactured and created the modern Korean city and social urban society. Before talking about the source, let me just define what I translate to apartment complex as patetanti. So apartment complex is the translation for that in Korean. So Apatte, as all of you are aware, is a transcription in Hangul of apartment. And the statistical definition of apatte is actually that of its English equivalent. So the apartment house is technically a building with at least 5 stories. So at this image of a Banpo, old Banpo apartment shows. So less than 5 stories, you are into different types of collective building. It's a difference in statistics. Now that the term Tanji, so the, sorry, the Chinese Hanmon didn't show, don't show on this slide, I don't know why. Anyway, it's made of 2 Chinese characters. One, Tan, means a sphere, mass, surround, limit, and the other, Ji, means land, earth, ground. So in Korean, the word recalls for a limited perimeter, a limited piece of land. It's a limited piece of land. So, in short, an apartment complex is a clearly delimited area of apartment buildings that is exclusively residential. The buildings, apartment buildings, are only residential, and they have at least 5 story. So it is also defined by a large number of housing units. And when we talk about an apartment complex in Korea, in the Korean case, the limit is 300 units, because this number is connected to specific legal constraints for the management of the complex. And also, the complex is also connected to the existence of master plan, allowing the construction in one piece of development, as opposed, for example, to a zone where detached dwelling can be constructed over a long time span. So the development is made in one piece and in a quite short time, usually 2-3 years. So the other normative elements of the apartment complex in Korea are the facilities within the complex. So you always have a maintenance office, so 관리사무소. You have, like, for example, Noinjang, you have how to designate that? A house for the elderly people. You also have in every complex, so shopping center and shops here and there. And you have also leisure facilities. So here in the Banpo apartment, you have tennis ground, you have a badminton court, things like that. So depending on the standing of the apartment, you have different kind of facilities. So that's the basically the definition of and what is an apartment complex. And I have to say that compared to the French complex, Korean complex were pretty well equipped with those facilities. So this is an important difference between the two cases. So as suggests the Konglish name, Apatte Danji, they are imported structures from the West, at least partially. And in fact, the morphology of the apartment complex shows a direct heritage from the modernist movement in architecture I mentioned in my introduction. But how did this modernist urban theories influence the model, the Korean model? And one important development that allows to decipher this source of the model is the one of the Mapo Apatte, the Mapo apartment, which was provided 642 units, and it was constructed between 1962 and 1964 by the Korean National Housing Corporation in Seoul, in Mapo-gu. And so this is the master plan of Mapo Apatte, which, as is very apparent on this slide, it stands as a coherent block, and you'll see just in a minute another picture showing how it stands against the rest of the urban fabric. And so map apartment were the first tanji, and it was the first of its kind. And it included basic facilities. So you have the buildings in black and in gray. It included a commercial center here and a children's playground and some squares, some areas, which was very new at the time, and it's a very new thing. And also when you look at the sources in Korean mentioning from where was the model come, where did the model come from for the map apartment, one reference that is always mentioned is the neighborhood unit, which was conceived by the American urbanist Clarence Perry in 1929. And actually, I think the neighborhood unit has been applied to the development of Canberra, for among other places. So what is very interesting here is that the neighborhood unit was, this concept was very closely linked to that of the garden city theory. And the garden city theory originally envisioned housing forms which were rather detached, a dwelling and low rise, which is not at all what Mapo apartment ended up being. As this picture shows, the choice for collective and high-rise housing was made for the Mapo apartment. So 10 buildings of 6 towers were constructed. And so this reflects that also the Korean intellectual context at the time was strongly influenced by the idea of Swiss architect Le Corbusier, who led a very different stream of modernism in architecture. This other stream, which was very different from that of the Garden City, was favored collective and high-rise buildings on the account that erecting taller residential building would leave more ground for leisure facilities and for green spaces. So what is quite interesting to state here is that the Korean complex appeared to be the result of a combination of two different fine theoretical models that were actually contradicted themselves in Europe. So the first one tends to promote low-rise, single-family homes. It's a garden city and the neighborhood unit. And the second one is Le Corbusier's housing unit of standard size. In other words, the giant collective building. And those two elements, the neighborhood unit and the giant collective building, were somehow considered as irreconcilable elements in the West. And Le Corbusier himself was criticizing very strongly the other theory. So to some extent, the choice of apartment in the Korean model is more the adaptation to the Korean context of a mixture of urbanistic theories developed in the West than just a basic transfer of one Le Corbusier theory, which is usually how it is viewed from France, especially because in France the construction of apartment was connected to a biased acceptance of Le Corbusier's theory. So the Korean model is quite complex, and it's also connected to the way how ideas and theories traveled to Korea. So in the complicated network where ideas and models are transferred, so three moments are important to mention in the formation of the Korean apartment complex model. First, the Japanese mediation during the colonial era was quite important. And as for daily and residential environments, first, apartment-like homes. They were not technically apartments, but they were apartment-like homes, collective housing, had been built during the Japanese time in the 1930s in Seoul. And also during the colonial era, the role of the Korean Housing Office, the Joseon Juttaek Kyongdam, created in 1941 was extremely important. Actually, less because of its practical action, it didn't really build that many houses. But they managed a couple of projects, and actually they were important because they had a very important theoretical influence on urban and housing development. So the housing project managed by the Joseon Juttakgyeongdam contributed to the spread of new housing models, which had been developed in Japan by a group of architects who were influenced by international and modernist urban theories. A second important network canal of diffusion is the direct contacts of professionals. And I will just evoke one very well-known example, the one of the very famous architect, Korean architect Kim Dong-hap, who worked with Le Corbusier's. He worked in Le Corbusier's studio between 1952 and 1956. So after coming back from France, Kim Dong-hap was literally speaking the architectural language of Le Corbusier. He was using the concrete, he was using pillars, exactly, because he had spent all that year in Le Corbusier's studio. And the third important way of diffusion as well, during that time where the model of apartment was elaborated, was the post-war reconstruction moment, because lots of foreign advisors, engineers, urban planners were involved with projects connected to the foreign aid to Korea. And for example, I can mention a project, first project, actually, the very first apartment building, which was not an apartment complex per se, it was just a couple of buildings, the Cheonggam Apart. It was built by the National Housing Corporation in 1958, so 4 years before Mapo Apartment, and it was actually at the origin of the word. And this project had received funding from the Agency for International Development, and foreign architects and engineers, and I think a German firm actually were involved in that project, so which also contributed to this general circulation of ideas why the model was being created. last but not least, something very important also has to be mentioned is that in a context of a very poor overall housing situation, I will develop in a minute, the apartments from the beginning were appeared as a symbol of economic and social progress and were made so by the government. So they were considered as a tool to improve the society. And for example, the Mapo Apartment, which, as I say, established the model of the Korean apartment, they were not only the result of all this mixture of modernist theories, they also appeared as a symbol of the modern Korean society. And you can find in that line the speech pronounced by Park Chung-hee at the inauguration of Mapo Apartment. So is very has like kind of Le Corbusier's rhetoric in it. So the apartment is the tool to make the modern era, the modern society. It will contribute to the improvement of the living conditions and the culture of our people. It's not only the living conditions. It's much more than materials. It's also creating a new era, a new culture, a new society. So in that sense, we can somehow say that the apartment was related to a modernist ideology, which is like considering as a system of value shaped by the belief in progress, in that the culture can progress, etc. So it was connected to that also. So, how was this model? So we saw how the model was kind of elaborated and how it was connected to this modernist ideology. So how was this model spread at such a large scale in South Korean cities. And I have to say that the scale of apartment development in South Korea was probably not even imagined by Le Corbusier himself when he wrote all his writing on cities. We have to insist on the fact that the rise of apartment in Korea came against a backdrop of exponential urban growth. So, you have like some aspect on this slide. So between 1965 and 1985, the urban population increased on average, because in Seoul it was much more than that, 5% per year. That means that the urban population is going to be doubled in around like 15 years. That's a huge pace. And Seoul itself acted as a kind of demographic pump in the country, so to speak, between 1960 and 1980, at the end of 1980s, because Seoul went from 2.5 million inhabitants in 1960 to more than 5 million people in 1970 and 8 million in the 1980s. So it's a really huge base, which has drastic influence on the landscape, of course. And so this pace, this brutal urban transition exacerbated in the cities the housing crisis, which actually dated back from the colonial era, plus the war and the Korean War. And, for example, I picked up some figures for the slide. The housing ratio, which is the number of households to the number of housing units, in Korean, the jeotakbogumyul, deteriorated considerably during the 1960s and the 1970s. And still, in the mid-80s, this housing ratio was only at 53%. So it's very low housing ratio. At the end of the 70s, still the level of housing amenities in Seoul was one of the elements contributing to Seoul's image at the time as a third world city, because in 1980, only 55% of overall housing units in Seoul were equipped with flushing toilets. 40% of housing units had no bathroom whatsoever, and 60% of those how they were coal heated, so they used yontan, so which was not so practical. Only 10% of the housing were equipped with central heating, so we tend to forget that now when we know Seoul. I mean, I never visited Seoul before the 1990s, so it's a totally different city. Yeah, beyond those bare figures, I have like two slides who may illustrate here the situation of housing in Seoul in the late 60s. And I actually owe them to one important figure of this Korean society in New York, Mr. Homer Williams. And he gave me the permission to show these really great pictures of Seoul in the late 1960s. So this is Yongsan in 1968. What is interesting is that this neighborhood with this individual houses is not at all comparable to third world shantytown. You see, they are in brick houses, but still this area is kind of between, however, barely looks urban, and has a very poor network, especially the roads are not paved, and so the network, it was not developed yet. And also this picture of a woman, so this was taken in 1969 by Homer Williams near Hanyang University, and so this woman is pumping water into a bucket, and so this kind of image was not uncommon at the time. So the facilities were very poor, and not only for the people living at the bottom of the social scales. So there was a really important housing problem. So the housing policy at the time was specifically oriented to solve this housing problem and to provide proper housing to the majority of the population. And to that, since 1962, the housing policy was connected to the five-year economic development plan. It's conceived within the framework of the five-year economic development plan. But the real drive towards mass housing was taken at the beginning of the 1970s. And, of course, this mass housing was based on apartment development, and for that, a very important law and tool was established. It's the Housing Construction Promotion Act of 1972, the Tuteconsultuktinpap. And this law gives basically the framework for the construction of apartments, and this law also facilitates their development. And as a matter of fact, this law is a so-called special law, Tukpyalpap, which can bypass, it overpasses the normal regulation of the City Planning Act and the Construction Act, which means that it's much easier to densify the neighborhood and to construct high-rise housing, even though it's not allowed in the City Planning Act. So the creation also of apartment districts, of apatatigu, in the cities, and especially in Seoul, was a direct consequence of that law, and it considerably facilitated the construction, the development of complexes. And two other important measures accompanied this law. The first one was the price control for new housing units, so it's for development over 20 units. So, of course, all apartment complexes came into that, the framework of price control. And also construction subsidies and help, such as tax incentives, things like that, or land were given to construction companies for to help them build apartment to give incentive to construction company to go into the apartment building. Somehow to compensate the price control for them. So this mass housing policy set very high targets for housing construction. But what really changed right at the beginning from the first plan at the beginning of 1970, so 800,000 units were to be built. But what you want to recall or remember is that the plan that really changed the Korean cities and the Korean cityscape was the 1988 housing construction program, which planned the construction of 2 million units over 5 years. And it shows really well in that graph. You see the number of housing just jumping. And it's housing, it's apartment construction in the whole country. So, since the 1990s, still the target for the construction of new homes remains roughly around 500,000 housing units per year, which is a huge quantity. Now, what is interesting to show in that graph is we can actually identify three periods of time. I lost my no, it's here. So the first, you see that before the 1970, there is nothing. So between 1970 and the 1980, you have like a steady growth, but the quantity is not huge compared to after the end of the 1980s. Well, the thing is, what you want to realize is that during the 70s and the 80s, the mass housing policy basically only applied concretely in Seoul. So all the apartments were constructed in Seoul, which changed the cityscape in Seoul first. And that explained the relatively small number of buildings constructed at the national level. But all the buildings constructed then were in Seoul, which was a fairly important quantity. So, and from the 1990, you see like the influence of this 1988 plan, and the direct consequence of that plan. So, but however, those figures make us kind of forget that things were not so simple to warm up Korean population in the 1970s. So why do I talk about the 1970s campaign for apartment? I think the well-known success of apartment, I mean, the fact that apartment life, has been a dream for lots of people in Korea, makes people forget that, at the time, at the beginning of the 1970s, the majority of Koreans disliked apartment. Apartment was not really, a very favored, housing environment. The reason why that was, most of the projects of the apartment project, that had been developed in the 60s were actually related to the redevelopment of slums around the city center, and small apartments only were constructed. And so despite of Park Chung-hee's prediction at the Mapo apartment inauguration, apartments were considered at the time as kind of social housing by the great majority. And what made things worse is like in 1970, April 1970, there was this major urban catastrophe, the wealth apartment collapsing. So one building of newly built complex, just a small complex, just collapsed. And so it made several deaths, and also it collapsed on houses, and this was so that the mayor of Seoul was actually had to resign, etc. It was a major urban catastrophe, and so at the time this added dangerous to the negative image of apartment, and so in Seoul, which has always been a symbolic and a center for urban development, a laboratory for urban development, the government literally undertook a campaign to warm up the citizen to apartment life. And also this campaign was going along with a drastic redistribution of the population in the city. So first of all, at the beginning of the 70s, So the housing policy of apartment shifted towards a luxury apartment construction. So luxury apartments complexes advertised the large apartments adapted to the needs of the leisure classes. And at the time, even well-off people were suffering from a general lack of comfortable living spaces. So complexes such as the Dongbu Icheon-dong Danji, which was completed in 1971 or 72, or the Banpo apartment complex, which was constructed between 73 and 78. So they reserved large apartments for sale to civil servants and other prestigious professions. And that was the first thing. The second thing was also the redesigning of the school districts, which was closely bound to housing development, to the development of Gangnam. At the time, this was the Gangnam development in the mid-70s. And so the redesigning of school district, basically the school district transplanted the best high schools to the south part of Seoul that was developing at the time. And so in a society that, as all of you know, attributes great importance to the education of its children, the transplanting of the best high schools to Gangnam, which was developing at the time, literally dragged the upper classes to the apartment that were blooming in that part of the city. And finally, the government also supported the construction of megaplexes, such as the Jamsil Danji, which provided smaller and mid-sized unit for the large range of the middle classes. So this was quite a coherent plan connected to a general, a national housing policy and a local redevelopment of the capital city of Seoul. So So in Seoul, the development of the Gangnam area saw the building of what I call the Great Wall of Apartments, which was the new frontier, the new urban frontier. It was creating a new city from scratch there. And so the urbanization of Gangnam was proceeded through land readjustment procedures undertaken by a public authority. And so the land to be urbanized was structured by a grid of large avenues. And so you have this grid, and it's about 800 meters wide inside. And inside the piece of land, so Danshi were constructed. That was the basic structure of Gangnam. In the macro block, the constructed megaplexes appeared. So in Seoul, the majority of urban redevelopment projects in the 1970s and the 1980s, they all concentrated south of the Han River. So first, by the creation of the riverbank of this Great Wall of Danshi, and you had like, it was quite interesting to see how it worked as an urban fabric dynamics. So bridge was constructed, and then the urban front was led by usually a public led development, and then the private sector took over and constructed other Danshi. So you had like here, for example, the Bumpo apartment, which was constructed by the National Housing Corporation, and then next to it you had apartment complex megaplexes constructed by the private sector, such as the well-known Apujong, for example. So in that part of the city, a totally new landscape was created basically from scratch. Before that, until the early 1970s, all that area was not urbanized. I assume that all of you know Seoul, so I didn't precise where was the historical center, but basically before the 1970, so the urbanization was north of the Han River and toward that direction. So, so this is basically the feature, the morphology, the basic morphology that appeared, in Gangnam. So, as an example of which is, this is the Changsil 5th Danshi, which was completed at the end of the 1970s. And although today, of course, the buildings are much higher and buildings maybe more fancy and everything, but I mean the basic morphology remains the same. Basically, it's high-rise building, and of course, the 15-story building here looked now rather low rise compared to the much higher building that emerged in the last decade. So high rise building, as a consequence, the architecture is very large sized and massive. And so what is also a very important aspect of that urban fabric is there was no mixture of function within buildings. So the shops are not in the buildings. These buildings are only residential, and there is a commercial center separately in the complex, but you don't have a mixed-used building at all in that new urban fabric. So this new landscape appeared first in Gangnam. But from the end of the 1980s, the apartment also began to develop within pre-existing urban fabric in already urbanized area. And I think this is probably looking very similar to the neighborhood you mentioned during the introduction of Mr. Carrera, I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. So this is a view of a neighborhood in Mapugu, in Shingongdakdong, so it's near Gongdak Station, and it was taken in 1994 when the area was an urban renewal district before renewal. As I said, so fabric is constantly changing. And so the process of urban renewal and the multiplication of urban renewal project was allowed again by the development of a special law, which, as all special law, overpasses the general regulation of city planning and City Planning Act and Construction Act. Basically, you can build high-rise building in an area where, in this zone, high-rise building are not allowed. But since it goes under this urban renewal law, so here is what you can construct, because this law is a special law. So this law indeed authorizes the association of private companies and resident association for the renewal of squatter settlements. And so basically the urban renewal process involves a private developer who builds an apartment complex, as it shows here, and as a result of the renewal, an apartment complex was built by Samsung Gonsol, that I call a miniplex. More to distinguish with other huge development in the new cities, because still it's a fairly important chunk of housing, about 1,200 units here. One important thing to note, as for the consequence of that kind of development, is that the result of the change of urban morphology is associated with a gentrification of the same area. So the families with lower means, they progressively drop out the renewal process and richer family come in. And even more interesting to note is that the population of the neighborhood sometimes does not increase significantly. Actually, usually it actually diminish. But of course, richer people come in and live in larger houses. So the connection between density and population density of apartment is not so easy actually to make. There is also a well-known social dimension to the development of apartment. In fact, it's connected to a making of to the also the rise of the middle class in Korea, and that's one last point I want to present before I let you ask question and reflect on that talk. I also call the apartment the urban middle-class production factory. And why do I say that? I think in explaining the efficiency of this urban middle-class production factory, the property acquisition process of the apartment, which is connected to the general framework of the housing policy, is very important. First, to note is that in Korea, the development of apartment was first based on a policy of home ownership. And this is very important because it makes the Korean case stand radically different from the majority of the European experience in France or Great Britain. For example, because in France or Great Britain, as you may know, apartment complexes provided mainly social housing and were managed by the public authorities as rentals. So this was not the fact in Korea. So the law I evoked earlier, the Housing Construction Promotion Law, created a price ceiling below market price for the new development, and of course that applied to apartment sales. And so the price control, so basically the apartment were sold below the market prices, and so of course it gives an incentive to buy. The policy the success of this policy is of course due to the price control principle, because it allows a quick capital gain for the buyer. Once you buy an apartment, a year after, it goes on the real price on the market. So, the price, increase. But also, it's quite interesting to know that this principle of price control was very well adapted to the characteristics of the Korean housing private rental market, shaped by the Chonsei system. Basically, the price control reduced the economic incentive to rent an apartment, and at the same time, the Chonsei system made home ownership economically possible for those people who had the first capital available in their Chonsei. If they were living in Chonsei, they had this capital potential, and they could use that as a first payment for an apartment. So, basically, contrary to European experiences, the rise of apartment in Korea was less related to a social housing policy, and it's not at all a social housing policy. It was connected to the provision of housing units for the most solvent sector of the population in a context of very rapid economic modernization. And so, the development of apartment indeed increased access to home ownership for the growing middle classes. And at the same time, the price control principle actually strengthened that status, because as soon as you were elected to buy an apartment, you actually increased your capital. You were consolidated as being in the middle class with this rapid increase of value because of the price control system. So somehow also the apartment became not only the symbol of modern life, as I said, but also a very important asset, if not a speculative object. Let me try to wrap up a little bit what I've said in the last hour or so. First of all, apartments have been a very effective solution to the housing problem. It's undeniable. And we have to acknowledge the fact that, considering the very drastic urban growth in Seoul, the rapid transformation of Seoul, Seoul is a city that actually works quite well. Despite all the images of traffic, automobile traffic, and etc., and as far as the housing problem is considered, the level of amenities in the housing also considerably improved, and that housing transformation was led by the development of apartment. Which, of course, does not mean that the social housing problem, which means that the housing directed to the poorer segment of the population, is solved. It's not. But it's not the focus of this talk. But moreover, than this just a solution to the housing problem, what I try to argue is that I consider them not only a consequence, not only an outcome of what we call the miracle of the Han River, the development, the growth of Seoul. It's also, it has been a matrix. It has been a tool. It has been a way to make Seoul what it is. Because for several intertwined reasons. Moreover, organized into this basic housing policy shaped toward the construction of apartment, we have also to think that the construction of apartment complexes was also a very important market for the construction industry, and itself the construction industry has been central to Korea's industrial development. So, and this construction very this construction industry, this important industrial sector, and all these services associated to it, like architecture, urbanism, city planning, all that provided also the middle class and upper middle class with jobs and also homes in the form of apartments. And as I said earlier, the price control system, which was associated with a lottery system as late as the 1998, so the price control system enabled a more solvent segment of the population to increase their wealth and to consolidate their belongings to the middle class. So somehow, as I said, the apartments seemed to manufacture members of the middle and upper middle class. What I didn't talk here in that talk, because I focused on the creation of the urban morphology, the transformation of the morphology, but there is a lot also to say about how apartments changed actually daily life and the way people used to live and to use their houses. That would be the topic of another talk. And also, lastly, and it's been documented by very important works by anthropologists working on Korean modern society, apartments also provided with the growing middle class with symbols with which to recognize their social standing. So in most of my interviews, people, if I ask them, so how do you recognize you are part of the middle class, they would say, oh yes, because I own an apartment and I own a car. So the apartment was kind of the symbol of the belonging to that segment. And which was very important also because at that moment, during that time, the rural exodus, the migration inside Korea, they disturbed, if not destroyed, traditional identity reference. So the Goyang, it's still there, but then coming into cities. So the apartment provided new symbols to which to recognize themselves. So that is why usually people consider that the development of a Korean apartment is the symbol of the westernization of South Korean cities, and actually I argue the contrary. It seems Western, and it's been influenced by Western theories, as I say, but it gives a very false impression of westernized. If not Americanized, it's not at all Americanized, an American style of environment at all. For example, here you see this a very specific pattern of suburbanization. In the West, suburbanization is led by detached dwelling going over rural land. Here you have a clash between paddies and apartment, and this is a very specific pattern to South Korean. Maybe to some extent, because the South Korean model is spreading throughout Asia now, to Asian suburbanization. So to conclude, I would say that Western modernism, as I said at the beginning of the talk, through the mixture of theories and models, was at the source of the Korean apartments. That, of course, the choice of that housing type has something to do with the high demographic pressure that generally characterizes Asian space organization on flatlands. I argue that this dominated visual traits of Korean cityscape is far from being the simple result of imported modernism or just a matter of land pressure. I think it's rather the product of a very Korean power structure of the period of the rapid economic growth, as this power structure were enacted into the housing policy, all the urban development, and how they started from Seoul, which is the center of the nation, and as I said, the laboratory of the nation development, the urban development. And so those housing policies, so the apartment also acted as a tool to control fast-growing cities and population. So far from just being the answer to urban growth or land pressure, the apartment development is a very broad social construct and very powerful. And I think that maybe the huge momentum acquired over the year by this social construct that touched lots of areas of Korean society somehow explains the bubble of apartment, the apartment bubble in certain areas, because the bubble does not touch all areas. And also why apartment is such a heated issue now in Korea nowadays. Well, thank you very much for your attention.
The opinions expressed at this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.